Responding to the threat against religious liberty and preparing for the Year of Faith were just two of the topics Chris Altieri discussed with the Bishop of Oakland, Salvatore Cotiglione, who is part of the contingent of U.S. bishops here this week for their ad limina visits from Region 11, comprising the states of Utah, Nevada, California, and Hawaii.
The Holy Father dedicated virtually his entire January 19th allocution to the subject of religious liberty, which he described as the first and most precious of our liberties. It's something that is very much on his mind, and I imagine it is because he keeps abreast, and also that you're informing him about what's going on. That's the purpose of the ad limina visit, among other things. Where do we stand in terms of the Church's response to what it has perceived as a very, very serious threat to the Church's ability to be present in society?
Where do we stand? We stand together. We stand united. This is a pivotal moment in the United States and in the life of the Catholic Church in the United States. It has very much galvanized the bishops and the people along with them in recognizing what is actually happening. I think for very many years, the bishops and leaders in the Church were more disposed toward recognizing goodwill, and even if there were some policy issues that we could not agree with, we presupposed goodwill and were willing to work as best we could. This has gone way over a boundary that is unacceptable, with the government intruding into the internal life of the Church and dictating to us what our moral conscience should be. All we want to do is serve our country, serve our communities in accordance with our conscience. And what our conscience dictates to us is not harmful to anyone. On the contrary, this is what is good for people. The government should be supporting faith communities who serve their wider communities, not supporting them in their acts of worship, in their catechesis, and so forth, but in their service to the community, because faith-based organizations do more and do better with less, because we're motivated by faith, by a higher calling. And this, I would hope we could come to a point of a mutual cooperation where we each, church and state, respect each other's role, as, of course, Pope Benedict the 16th explained and taught so very well in his first encyclical, God is Love.
I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, the Church's position has the best interests of women specifically, and of humanity in general, in mind. It's something that bears mention, because in the narrative, the dominant narrative during this whole crisis, if you will, it's very often couched as the Church's right to withhold services versus people's right to health care. And I just wonder, how well are we doing in the old basic journalistic trick of not granting the premise, resting back control of the narrative, I guess, is what I'm...
For the last 40 years, in my opinion, we've done a very poor job of that. The strategy for those who oppose us on these very important issues is that if you change the language, change the vocabulary, you've won the argument. We've gone along with that too easily. So they don't speak about abortion, they speak about choice. You know, they don't speak about changing the definition of marriage, they speak about equality. This has gone on over and over again. So we need to recognize this and not allow it to happen. I'm very happy that we bishops are focusing on what this issue is really about, which is an issue of religious liberty. And we're not allowing them to steal the narrative from it and from us and turn it into an issue of contraception or women's health. At the same time, in the public debate, we have to keep focused on that. We also have a great opportunity to do a better job at teaching our people about the evils of contraception and why they are so harmful. It is so ironic and insidious that the government would insist that organizations provide, for the sake of women's health, provide a drug which is known to be a risk factor for breast and cervical cancer, and which the World Health Organization categorizes as a class 1 carcinogen. And yet, providing that is supposed to be doing something in favor of women's health.
If I could, in a nutshell, you're talking almost as though the bishops are for the first time being forced by circumstances to make the argument, as it were. And this is something that's going to affect and has already begun to affect the way that the bishops and pastors of the church talk to the faithful themselves, inform the faithful, teach the faith. At the same time, the broader national conversation is one that we have to be engaged in, and there we come across people who don't share our basic presuppositions. Does this create tension, and how do you think the bishops ought to manage the tension between the ad intra and the ad extra when there's this broad overlap?
I think, first of all, are we forced? I wouldn't say so much we're forced now to teach, do a better job at teaching about the responsible parenthood and the whole contraception issue. Bishops have been doing that all along. What I'm saying is this provides us with a unique opportunity because it is front, even though it's not the focus of our debate on the national front, it is a front center issue, and it's a very delicate issue. It's very sensitive. It's hard to approach, so it makes it hard to just bring up as a topic. But here it's staring us in the face, so it's an I speak of it as an opportunity. With regard to those who disagree with us on this issue or might not understand what we believe about it and know about it, because I'm sure if they did, they would understand why we hold the position that we do, and they would do the same. Nonetheless, they recognize the threat to religious liberty. And I'm very gratified as well by the coming together of so many different faith communities that recognize this threat, because they recognize the same thing can happen to them. They recognize that this is just the next step. What's the next step after that? If this goes through, there's nothing to stop the government from requiring faith communities to cover abortion in their insurance package and so forth. Where is it going to end? People have woken up and they realize what these threats really are about. I think we've done a very good job in partnering, I think for a long time now, since the Second Vatican Council and the whole focus of our ecumenical efforts. I think we've done a good job partnering with people in other faith communities, and especially now at this point when we recognize that all of us are threatened on the basis of our religious liberty.
The coming year is bringing, is going to be the year of faith. And it's something that the Holy Father has wanted for the whole church. It's no accident that it comes on the 50th anniversary of the Council. He's talked about that. Why don't we start with you just telling us maybe about how the Diocese of Oakland is getting ready?
We've just initiated a discussion. In fact, the day before I left for Rome, I met with the Presbyteral Council, and this was one of the central topics on the agenda. So we're really just beginning discussions about it. One of the priests in the diocese in particular was pushing that we put something in place, and I was grateful for that. So we've formed a committee. They're going to look into different possibilities, look at the suggestions that the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith gave. One thing I mentioned, it's also the 20th anniversary of the Catechism of the Catholic Church. One thing I thought we could focus on is there's the Catholic Catechism for the United States that the USCCB put together several years ago. I think we should probably put some focus on this catechism. Each chapter concludes with the story of a great Catholic American, and they're very inspiring stories, and they're very close to home. So it really brings the faith home to us and gives a better appreciation of the whole history of our church in the United States and this immigrant people and the church buildings and the infrastructure they built up and the power of their faith and the contribution that we've made to the United States and how we benefited from the United States. The whole council's teaching on religious liberty we know came out of the American experience and how Catholics, and all new immigrants to this country have had a hard time figuring out how to fit in, and we were no exception, but we did. We figured out how to be Catholics in a country that was inspired by really a Protestant ethos, but because of religious liberty and the respect for that everyone in the country has had, at least up until now, our church has been able to thrive here. So I think that Catholic Catechism for the United States it should be a central focus on the Year of Faith. Of course, also the 50th anniversary of this beginning of the Second Vatican, the call for the Second Vatican Council, is a very timely moment to. I'm so grateful to our Holy Father's teaching, urging us to this rereading of the Council, to see it through the lens of the hermeneutic of continuity and reform. There's been so much rupture and disrupture in the life of the Church. I think we need to, now that we have a distance of 50 years, maybe there can be a little less emotional volatility to, in a more sober, calm way, to reread that Council and ponder more deeply what its teaching really is and how we can apply that to the life of the Church today.
With all of the upheaval in the past 5 decades, and people my age who grew up in the middle and toward the tail end of it, we don't really know any other ecclesiastical climate. But really, in the life of the Church, for the in a period of adjustment after a council, this isn't all that unusual, is it? Is that a fair thing to say?
Yes, that's fair, although I would qualify by saying usually there's some kind of disruption before the council, which is why the council is called. In this case, was the matter of, of course, Dave Erben reading the signs of the times. The Church saw the direction the world was moving in, very much down the road in the post-Enlightenment worldview, and how we needed to rethink of better communicate the gospel. So there was certainly disruption and, two world wars and, the spread of communism and all of that that the world suffered in the 20th century, but not so much in terms of the internal life of the Church, doctrinal issues and that sort of thing. So the Second Vatican Council was a little different in that sense. Now, it always does take time to understand a council and interiorize it, integrate it, and apply it for the life of the Church, and we have experienced some disruption after the council, but I think we're beginning to get a better idea of how we can, we're beginning to understand better, I think, the vision of the Council Fathers, and then therefore how we can apply it more effectively to the life of the Church, to more effectively communicate the gospel in now a post-Enlightenment world, post-modern world.
And this rereading of the Council through what you were calling with the Holy Father, the hermeneutic of continuity, is the sort of the theoretical plant or slant behind the new evangelization, which is also a major focus of the Year of Faith. And it's something that the Church is very excited about. Lots of people are geared up and ready to work hard, but not to put too fine a point on it, everyone seems to have his own idea about what the new evangelization is. And I was wondering what you think of it.
Just yesterday we had our meeting at the new Pontifical Council for the promotion of the new evangelization. And as it was explained, the first evangelization, ad gentes, is, to those who haven't heard of Jesus Christ. It's the first time they're receiving the good news. The new evangelization is focused on those who are, at least theoretically, believers, but have fallen away. So in societies that are traditionally Christian, but now have become very secularized, and where the faith, the Christianity informing the life of society has now waned. So it's really geared toward reactivating people who for generations their societies have been imbued by a Christian faith and no longer are. So it's sort of in a sense a re-evangelization. I think that I agree with you. The hermeneutic of continuity, I believe, is a key ingredient to this. Again, I'm so grateful to the Holy Father for reminding us and urging us to recognize that what has always been held as sacred through the ages of the Church doesn't stop being sacred. We need to treasure this precious patrimony we have of the arts, of our liturgy, of our spirituality, all the cultural contributions the Church has made, but especially as that's been expressed in the liturgy, is something we still need to treasure and preserve. Well, also we move forward. Now, the Holy Father speaks and initially spoke more of the hermeneutic of reform. And now I hear the phrase continuity and reform. So it's both. It's a hermeneutic of continuity, but for the purpose of reform, the Church needs this ongoing reform.
The reform of the reform,
yes,
is another expression that you've,
yes,
heard.
Yes.
But generally,
the driving idea behind it is that the council didn't take place in a vacuum, either an historical or a cultural one, and that it should be read in the light of, you know, the previous councils of the church. And that doesn't sound to me like a terribly controversial proposition, and yet we've seen a lot of warm reaction to it, not necessarily favorable. Why is that? Is it do people not understand what we mean by that, or do they, and are they again? What's that about? If I could put it that broadly,
if I may be frank, I think I'm going to go to my grave asking that question. I don't understand it myself. Why there was such a violent reaction to what was held as sacred just a few years before. So many stories of churches that have been, a poor immigrant people built up these beautiful churches and how they were destroyed. Marble, beautiful works of art, marble altars, and then consecrated for sacred use, being literally pulverized and replaced with a chair. It seems to me almost there was a certain, I guess, spirit that people got caught up into when a misinterpretation. You're so right about reading the council in light of what came before, and especially with regard to liturgical matters, we can see how it was the fruit of that over 100 years liturgical renewal movement going on in the church, which never was envisioned as a rupture of what came before, but was promoting the full active conscious participation of the people for so very long.
The other thing that the Holy Father's done in connection with this was in 2007 with Summorum Pontificum. And basically what that document says is, well, if you want to use the old books, go ahead and use the old books, and let's just leave it at that. And for this liberalization of the church's liturgical life, the Holy Father got a lot of flack for being reactionary, and is he going to turn back the clock on everything? I was surprised by that too. But I wonder where the idea that the option is binary, you know, either cut off from the past and we go forward and we never look back, or we ossify ourselves in this sort of cultural, you know, antiquated cultural museum. They don't seem like real alternatives to me, and I'm wondering why the debate in the internal life of the church has turned out so often to be basically a choice between these two made-up alternatives.
The Holy Father is charting the right course for us, which is reform of the reform, as you had mentioned. It's not the one extreme nor the other extreme, obviously. As I understand his teaching, he believes, and I can appreciate this wholeheartedly, that the traditional form of the Mass has a role to play in the ongoing effort of liturgical renewal and reform of the Church. It has a role to play. It is our patrimony, the liturgy of Pope St. Gregory the Great, the way the Church has worshipped for many, many centuries, at least 1,500 years, you know? So it has a role to play, but it's not just like erasing the last 50 years to go back to the way things were before. I can appreciate people who grew up in that era having a nostalgia for it. In a certain sense, it was a unique, privileged Catholic moment in the country. But things change, and the Church should not change to keep up with society. I think that was kind of another improper hermeneutic of the council, but the Church needs to adapt to how society is changing in order to communicate to the society. I think the what so often becomes the banalization of the liturgy is not working. And it's interesting to see how many young people, when they're exposed to the old Mass, are excited by it, are attracted to it, even without understanding it in depth. There is something timeless about it. And I think we need to learn from that, because the alternative, this sort of post-Enlightenment world that we're living in, where everything is subjectivized and everything is fluid, everything is relative, it just doesn't work. It doesn't work. I think we need to... The church, great contribution our church makes is knowing that we need both faith and reason to arrive at the truth. The Enlightenment, of course, took faith out of the equation. It was all based on reason. Someone once asked me, what's the difference between modernism and postmodernism? And this is what I said. Modernism, that is, at the Enlightenment, took faith out of the equation. It was all based on reason. Well, the church could still engage in a dialogue because at least we had the field of reason to talk on. Postmodernism now does away with reason. It's a completely irrational at all. It's all up to how I want the world to be, and people have to respect that without any basis for reason. So that's what makes it so challenging for the church now in a postmodern world. But that gets old very fast, and I think people are realizing that what is eternal, which what the church has preserved in the deposit of the faith and the church's worship and the teaching of God, that God is love, Pope Benedict's first encyclical, that's what attracts. And that's what holds us, that's what makes us truly human.
Bishop Cordiglione, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.